Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
All right, everyone. Welcome. A few people might still file in. That's fine.
We'll have everyone. So welcome to the LSE for this event. This is hosted by the Department of International Relations. Warm welcome to everyone. Thanks for making time in your schedule, both in the theater and online, wherever you may be. Before we can get started, please could you make sure that your mobile phones are either switched off or in silence for the duration of this event. Thanks for doing that. So just for sort of a little bit about who's here and about the structure of the event. So my name is Dinya Graf. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of International Relations. My research looks at international theory and international law. And specifically, I study the relationship between normative universals and the legitimacy of political violence. This evening, Dr. Elif Kalajioglu will present her new book, fresh out, or no longer so fresh, but here. They're fresh still, published by Oxford University Press. The book is titled The Politics of World Heritage, Visions, Custodians, and Futures of Humanity. And this will be followed by a brief discussion and then by a Q&A. We will take questions both from the audience here and from the audience online as well. Just a little bit about the book. The study examines the permutations of a global cultural history of humanity, which has emerged through decades of world heritage politics. Within this history, Dr. Kalajioglu excavates the exclusions, hierarchies, and contradictions that challenge UNESCO's mandate of fostering global peace and security and solidarity. Not actually solidarity more than security. In doing so, or maybe we'll see. The book identifies what the author calls nested constructions of humanity, which refuse flat universalisms and which circulate within the regime, yet yielding more robust possibilities, the author claims, for peace and solidarity. So for our panel then tonight, our speaker is Dr. Elif Kalajioglu, who is a lecturer at the War Studies Department at King's College London. And prior to joining KCL, she taught at the University of Alabama and held a postdoctoral position at Princeton University's Niehaus Center for Globalization and Governance. She received her PhD from the University of Minnesota and her MSc in European Studies from the LSE. Her research is on the role of cultural and historical resources in the conduct of global politics, with an empirical focus on global heritage politics and UNESCO World Heritage Regime politics. Her articles have appeared in the Review of International Studies, International Theory, International Political Sociology, and in the Oxford Research Encyclopedia of International Relations. Our discussant then is Dr. Alvina Hoffman, who is a lecturer in diplomatic studies at SOAS, University of London. And before joining SOAS, she taught at King's College London and at Queen Mary University of London. She holds a PhD from King's College London and a master's from Sciences Po Paris and an MSc from the LSE. Her research and teaching interests cover human rights and humanitarianism, the sociology of elites and experts, transnational professionals, socio-legal studies, and the United Nations. So for the event tonight, the format is basically we'll have a presentation by Elif, and then we'll have commentary and discussion from Alvina, and then we'll end with the audience and questions from you, again, both here and online. For the online audience, you can submit your questions via the Q&A feature, which is at the top left of your screen. And for everyone, please, if you could, whether online or here, if you could remember to state your name and affiliation when you also submit your question or state your question. For those here in the theater, I'll let you know when we open the floor for questions. Obviously, you can raise your hand and then please wait when you do receive the microphone because the event will be recorded. So it's even if you think you don't need the mic, it's a little bit easier if you just take it and ask you a question with the microphone. I will then also ask you to briefly provide your name and affiliation before you pose your question. And we'll have sort of a range of question, a mix, both from the online audience and from folk here in the theater. For Twitter users, which we're no longer calling that, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE events as one word, which gives it a double E in the middle. please know that this event is also being recorded, and it will hopefully, barring any technical glitches, it will be made available as a video and as a podcast later on. And now I'm delighted to hand things over to Elif.
I will now start by awkwardly walking to the podium to set our recording.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. I think this is from where I'm projecting, so I'll speak to my lapel mic. Thank you for coming. Someone suggested this should be called IR After Dark. So I do recognize that it's late, and I appreciate you joining, and especially Sinia and Alvina for agreeing to chair and discuss this respectively. Okay, so let's start. Developing his theory of just wars in the 1970s, political theorist Michael Walzer wrote of humanity that it has members but no memory, and so it has no history and no culture. Writing on cosmopolitan harm conventions in the 2010s, international relations scholar Andrew Linklater similarly identified humanity as a blank area on the emotional map, lacking narratives of its origins. Not long after Linklater's writing, in 2016, the International Criminal Court, ICC, would try Ahmed Al-Faqi Al-Mahdi for his role in the destruction of 10 Sufi shrines in Timbuktu, Mali. Leading up to the verdict, an expert report that was commissioned by the ICC opined that the loss of these sites destroys part of humanity's shared memory and collective consciousness, and renders humanity unable to transmit its values and knowledge to future generations. The ICC's reparations order quoted this opinion verbatim, adding that the destruction was an irreplaceable loss that negates humanity. Al-Mahdi was found guilty of war crimes for the intentional destruction of historic monuments and religious buildings. He was sentenced to 9 years in prison and ordered to pay compensation to the victims of his crime, that is, residents of Timbuktu, Malians, and the international community. In contrast to Walzer and Linklater's pessimistic diagnosis, then, the ICC case seems to suggest that humanity has a shared memory rooted in cultural history, and that the right to such memory can authorize international action at times. But then, how did Timbuktu's Sufi shrines become humanity's shared memory and collective consciousness to begin with? Well, 9 of the 10 destroyed shrines had been designated as World Heritage Sites. And this designation was in fact integral to the court's identification of humanity as a legacy that values these sites and that suffers from their destruction. The Convention Concerning the Protection of the World Cultural and Natural Heritage, or World Heritage Convention for short, was signed in 1972 and entered into force in 1978. It has since become UNESCO's flagship program, if not a household or tourist guidebook name, and it currently has 196 state signatories. What you see on the slide is the convention's preamble, which really spells out the idea that grounds world heritage. Parts of the world are of such outstanding interest that they need to be preserved as part of the world heritage of mankind as a whole. This outstanding interest has been called outstanding universal value, and because everything has an acronym, it's OUV. And in fact, the same expert report explained that the destroyed Sufi shrines possessed precisely this outstanding universal value and thus had to be preserved for present and future generations of humanity. And if you think that's ambitious, the goal of World Heritage doesn't stop there either, but it's to value and preserve these sites to contribute to the promotion of global peace and solidarity in line with UNESCO's broader aims. In this case, the aspiration is to generate solidarity as fellow members of a cultural historical humanity and to ground global peace on that shared identification. On the one hand, then, the spirit of the regime is not so different from what Walzer and Linklater says, that if humanity could have these narratives of its origins, that it could ground a much more robust solidarity. On the other hand, despite the ICC judgment, I think we can say that the scholars are not wrong in their skepticism and that these narratives of humanity do not exist, and if they do, they're not readily obvious. So I propose in the book that the World Heritage regime operates precisely at this tense intersection. While the preamble of the convention asserts that there exist in the world places of outstanding interest to humanity, much of the rest of the convention is shot through with the language of identification and interpretation. In other words, certain cultural and natural sites need to be identified and interpreted as possessing this value. It is that very identification and interpretation which constitutes some material sites in the world as humanity's shared heritage. Or to put another way, the regime constructs its humanity. It's precisely this dynamic that we see in the quote from UNESCO's former Director General Nabau's speech after the inscription of Chartres Cathedral. It is the inscription that makes these sites, henceforth, part of, in the gendered language of the time, mankind's essential knowledge of its history. What's at stake, then, are productive world-making politics. And before I move on to the analysis of these politics, two quick caveats. One, I'm going to say inscription quite a bit, and it's going to sound all evocative and fancy. It's just a direct translation of the French word for registration, and that's just how the regime refers to the process of just adding sites onto the list. So nothing inscriptive is really happening in this more sort of metaphysical sense. That's one. Two, I'm only going to talk about cultural heritage. And this is a distinction that's built into the regime. And I'm happy to talk about why that's wrong and how people have been saying it's wrong, or if what I have to say has any bearing on the other part of it. But I am going to be focusing on cultural heritage from here on. So my book then centers these productive politics and really is grounded on the question of, well, what does it take to construct humanity's cultural history and what do these efforts produce in the world? The analysis is to say, well, this is a productive politics with humanity really at its center. And what I do across the three empirical chapters is to track the multiple visions of humanity that have marked the regime over the over 50 years of its implementation by now, and crucially, the social and political orders that emerge in tandem with these humanities. So to pursue that analysis, as a good academic should, I suppose, I first construct a framework on what is politics of humanity. And I define it again as politics that are authorized by this idea of humanity, but that then have to bring it into being. And the wager there basically is that as a political subject with cultural, juridical, or any other rights, humanity does not exist readily available in nature, but has to be constructed through these institutionalized and other mechanisms. And that's precisely what World Heritage does. And it's really this idea that the book's cover encapsulates. I know sometimes our covers are chosen by publishers and we have to account for them. But in this case, it was actually found by my partner after reading the book many times. And it really encapsulates this idea. It's an image from the 1972 meeting that adopted the World Heritage Convention. And what I really like about it is that the stage and the mic are empty. Okay, they're empty, but they're also flanked, and they're flanked by state delegations, UNESCO officials, as well as experts. So through the years of the regime's implementation, these participants will represent humanity in the World Heritage nominations they put forward and in their evaluations of those nominations. It is, in fact, through those representations that a cultural, historical humanity will be constructed through World Heritage.
Now, if humanity comes into being through its representations, then the resources with which we represented are of critical importance to its construction and to its politics. In the book, I call these resources symbolic universes. And in the case of World Heritage, what I mean by that are what cultural and historical resources are institutionalized to decide what is outstanding universal value, which sites have it, and therefore which sites represent humanity's shared cultural history.
Okay, so let me show you both of those.
Okay, so the construction of humanity through these resources, I'm going to argue, is generative of social orders. As states, experts, and civil servants represent humanity through the resources that circulate within World Heritage, they're also going to make claims to being contributors to, custodians of, or adjudicators of humanity. These are prestigious subjectivities of inheriting, but also being able to judge or having contributed to humanity's shared history. And the social order I'm going to show is not only prestigious, but it also has its hierarchies. For example, some contributors are going to be central to humanity, as you already see on the world map, right? I see the eyes starting to take in some of those hierarchies, and others are going to become more marginal to it. So I conceptualize in the book three hierarchies: hierarchies of subjectivities, who can speak on humanity's behalf, who gets to judge its history as universally valuable, hierarchies of subject positions, who's central to it and who's on the sidelines, and then finally, hierarchies of subjectivities, what are the narratives through which we become valuable parts of humanity. So the two visuals then illustrate some, but not all, of these hierarchies. These are actually the two forms in which you would see the World Heritage List. If you Googled it, it exists only in virtual form. And on the world map, what you see are the green dots are cultural sites, the yellow dots are natural sites, and the red dots are sites that are in conservation danger. And what it produces, essentially, a map of the world in which some parts are essentially terra nullius in relation to humanity's cultural history, and other sites seem to be quite densely populated. Alternatively, in its default form, the list is organized with World Heritage sites listed under the states that have territorial sovereignty over them. We might think that in this form, the World Heritage List looks kind of like a national cultural honors roll. But what I'm going to say is there's actually something a bit more that's happening, because it's a more than national honors roll in which some states get to claim that the sites within their boundaries have this universal importance, not just for them, but also for everyone else. So it's theirs, but it's also important for humanity. So there's a higher kind of prestige that's attached to it. Okay, so at this point, I should say, I'm not the first to talk about hierarchies of humanity. I, in fact, am very happy to be joined by two others who have thought very deeply about humanity's politics and who gets to speak on its behalf and what are the kinds of hierarchies and politics that emerge through it. Where I kind of take a less well-trodden path is to say, what happens when we look at this in the case of culture, and it then tends to foreground dynamics of prestige recognition a lot more starkly than maybe some of the other domains. Okay, and finally, and I don't have a visual for it, but another thing I'm going to talk about is when we construct humanity, we're also attaching political visions to it. And certain actions, certain political imaginaries become possible, feasible, or sanctioned in relation to these various constructions of humanity. Okay, so again, I'm going to talk about these three periods, but I assume and maybe even a little bit hope that, unlike me, you haven't spent the last decade of your life thinking about World Heritage. And if that's the case, this is how a site becomes World Heritage. One day you're not, and the next day you are. It takes more than a day, but this is the process. So first, nomination dossiers are submitted by states that have territorial sovereignty over a site, and those states are the only ones that can nominate sites. When they nominate a site, they have to make the case for why it has outstanding universal value. And to do that, they're going to need to use the resources that the system has institutionalized, right? So that's the symbolic universe there. Then those files are evaluated by experts affiliated with the International Council on Monuments and Sites. And they're going to give one of four verdicts: immediately inscribe, revise and resubmit, or reject. And then the final decisions are going to be made at the annual World Heritage Committee meeting by a delegation of rotating 21 state delegations. So that's how you go from being a cathedral to a World Heritage site. So when the World Heritage regime came into being, it was grounded on a vision of humanity as a rarefied transhistorical subject that is the depository of the highest form of human creative and aesthetic genius, humanity as the best of us. The resources for representing this humanity and its cultural history were grandeur, rarity, scientific and technological acumen, and world historical movement and impact. Judging particular material sites against these criteria, some international experts became positioned as adjudicators of humanity's heritage. And given the sort of predominance of art historical, urban, and world historical resources, it was the kind of experts with that kind of fluency. The rest of the social and political visions would emerge as the regime was implemented. Okay. I've conveniently highlighted the important parts on here. So what you see on the board are the six criteria that were in effect at this period and comprise and evidence the symbolic universe at work. This is how OUV was operationalized, and you needed to meet one of these criteria at least to become World Heritage. They were formulated by ICOMOS in 1976 and slightly amended by states before they entered into force. This was again a time when both ICOMOS and states that were central to the regime were predominantly European, Western European, and North American. In fact, during the early discussions of these criteria, UNESCO's former Director General, Amadou Makhtar Mbow, who was Senegalese, and actually there's a lot more to be said about him, but we'll bracket that for now, but he urged in a handwritten note I found attached to an internally circulated memo, quote, "Take care that the evaluation criteria are not established on the basis of cultural designs valid only for part of the world," and that call would go unheeded. You see then that these are the cultural and historical resources I mentioned a moment ago: monumentality, grand civilizational artifacts, town planning, a progressive and irreversible course of world history. These were the resources with which a rarefied transhistorical humanity could be constructed through the designation of its material heritage. It's probably not surprising then that this is the shape of the early World Heritage List that emerged when these criteria were attached to concrete sites via nominations and evaluations. The list represented a cultural historical humanity which had its beginnings in Africa. This humanity then moved through the Middle East and North Africa, primarily through Greco-Roman sites. These sites were valued for attesting both to aesthetic genius and to urban planning that marked man as rational and separated him from nature, again, in the gendered language of the time. Humanity then had its long stay and center of gravity in Europe, the primary location of its aesthetic genius, attached primarily to cathedrals and palaces. From there, the list showed, the world historical arc moved to the so-called New World, which became visible and valuable through monumental indigenous sites as well as colonial cities. The experts praised these colonial cities as demonstrations of ingenuity in the adoption of universal aesthetic styles to local conditions. The regime's implementation then generated some clear hierarchies of subject positions, with Europe, not surprisingly, becoming central to the cultural history of humanity understood as such. But there were also further narrative hierarchies in terms of how particular sites became visible and valued. In the book, I illustrate these through colonial sites. For example, Portugal proposed and ICOMOS adopted the language of voyages of discovery to describe and valorize sites that marked both the origin and destination points of the colonization of South America. These destination points then entailed fraught negotiations for newly postcolonial states. For example, colonial towns bore the mark of monumentality and art history that would be easily legible to the regime as potentially possessing outstanding universal value. But if the subjectivity of having contributed to humanity's shared pool of cultural treasures is a coveted one, how might postcolonial states claim that subjectivity through colonial sites? And these hierarchies also raise a further question. Did participants make the case for other resources? Did they try to valorize other forms of humanity, or did they go along with what was on offer? Well, to answer the question, starting with the last one, I began by analyzing sites that were nominated by states but negatively evaluated by experts at this point. These were, for the most part, similar kinds of sites, forts, archaeological digs. They deployed the same kinds of cultural resources, but the experts thought the sites did not raise to the level of OUV. For example, Zanzibar was docked for having preserved, quote, only recent vestiges of its old history, and for these vestiges being more, again, quote, oriental rather than African in appearance, an influence that apparently did not carry the sign of the universal. There were a few exceptions. Plovdiv, Bulgaria, was rejected by experts because it's difficult at this stage to include urban sites for vernacular architecture. The symbolic universe, in other words, was not well suited to representations of a lived humanity. Then, as a second cut, I read the nomination files and experts' evaluations of colonial sites against one another to see if the same resources were mobilized differently in representing humanity's cultural history and one's place within it. The nomination and evaluation narratives of colonial sites in South America have remarkable consistency when it comes to valuing grandeur and art historical styles. But whereas the experts emphasize the adoption of universal styles to local circumstances, the nominations talk about mestizo Baroque or Antigua Baroque. These additions actually reinflect the meaning of outstanding universal value to the emergence of new styles and not just the adaptation of the universal to the local. In this way, the nominations claim postcolonial subjects as shapers of universal value, producing, quote, major contributions to universal art and paintings worthy of the world's leading museums. Some of these creative engagements also took up world history. The file supplemented ICOMOS's frame of exploration with the language of expansion, conquest, occupation, extraction, and subjugation, also making room for histories of resistance. And some reversed the arc of world history from one that travels with Europeans to the rest of the world to propose that the colonies made European economy and history. I don't want to glorify these nomination files because they too run into their limits. For example, in seamlessly incorporating Indigenous resistance to national liberation. What I want to emphasize, rather, is that in their quest for a place in the social order, these nomination files, on the one hand, reproduce the valorization of grandeur and monumentality, but on the other hand, took up these resources in ways that departed from that of the experts, and in that departure brought up some of the otherwise elided underbellies of humanity. Those elided underbellies of humanity also present questions of what visions of peace and solidarity articulated consistently by UNESCO officials as part of the regime's goals could emerge in relation to this iteration of humanity. The broad aspiration of the regime was to generate solidarity by emphasizing the positive accomplishments of humanity. And yet, challenges beset that aspiration. Some of these challenges were grounded in the very artifacts through which this rarefied humanity was represented. Monumental artifacts are intricately connected to economic and political consolidation as their conditions of possibility and also in what they celebrate. I talk in the book about the narrative strategies expert evaluations adopted in an attempt to separate the violent and hierarchical underbellies of these artifacts from their celebration as testaments to an outstanding aesthetic genius that can be universally admired. At work, then, was a monumental solidarity that would emerge from shared identifications with this outstanding humanity and its grand cultural constructions over world historical time. The first image you see is from Ikomos's evaluation of Cusco. It attests both to this monumental solidarity and also to its limits. It refers to the indigenous site on which the colonial city was raised. And if you think it's anachronistic to sort of put this as proof of the limits of monumental solidarity, much later in when the UNESCO Nubian rescue operation was underway, which would result in the foundation of the regime, enormous amounts of money were sort of collected to rescue the Nubian temples that were at risk of inundation in Egypt and Sudan. The temples were cut up and relocated and reassembled at higher ground. But the same rescue operation could not find funds to help with the displacement of present-day Nubians that lived around those monumental sites, but could not make their presence valued within the same symbolic universe. Another challenge then was what to do with sites nominated as representing moments in world history with universal significance, but not with positive valence, and also not attached to grand cultural productions. Two such nominations were in fact submitted already in the first round in 1978, the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp and Île de Gorée. The second image you see is part of the nomination file submitted by Senegal for Île de Gorée, a key port for the transatlantic slave trade. Here, once again, we see the regime's resources as key to the site's representation, specifically progressive world historical ones. The nomination's justification of universal value emphasized that the interest in nominating the island is not prompted by a wish to linger over a past that is buried forever. Further, the file notes, the nomination is driven by humanistic considerations, reconciliation, dialogue, exchange of noble ideas, and forgiveness. The president of ICOMOS would in fact comment positively on this framing, noting the significance of the nomination as residing precisely in Senegal's intention to make it into a place of dialogue. The question, however, is the scope and substance of the dialogue when that history to which it refers is cast as bygone and not enduring in its afterlives. In this early period of the regime's implementation, then, alongside these entrapments of subjectivity, prestige, and recognition, there was also growing unhappiness with its emergent hierarchies. A subgroup of experts would be instrumental in turning that unhappiness into a paradigm shift, which brought into the regime's symbolic universe new resources that would valorize a diverse living humanity and its cultural productions. Key to this shift were anthropologists who pushed for the inclusion of resources such as vernacular and know-how, as well as Canadian and Australian experts who, rooted in recent domestic contestations around Indigenous heritage, pushed for a rethinking of nature-culture relations. So once again, I've highlighted the changes to the OUV criteria that resulted from this paradigm shift, including the introduction of cultural traditions, living cultures, landscapes and land use, as well as cultural exchanges. These new resources were brought in to represent, value, and construct the new vision of a diverse and living humanity. With the introduction of these resources, the previously rejected Zanzibar would become World Heritage, this time praised as a site that demonstrates an outstanding fusion of culture. Indigenous sites in Australia and New Zealand, which were previously inscribed only as natural heritage, became re-evaluated and recognized as also having outstanding cultural value. These shifts in the vision of humanity and the resources of its representation then had repercussions for its social order. The changes to the social order also included the renewed importance of local experts. Previously, local experts were given financial aid to receive conservation training in Europe. With this paradigm shift, they became figures who knew about the sites that could fit this vision of humanity. At the same time, states began to increasingly refer to local experts as figures that were better suited to judge the cultural productions of a diverse humanity, given their contextual rather than universal knowledge. This paradigm shift was, on the whole, a positive development in thinking about humanity in more capacious and less hierarchical ways. But it wasn't all smooth sailing. The symbolic universe was expanded to include vernacular, non-monumental heritage, but these stood alongside long-valued monumentality and grandeur. What resulted were new negotiations of how to represent oneself as part of this social order, especially for those that were previously marginalized. These negotiations run through multiple nomination files, but they're succinctly captured in the report from an early workshop organized by ICOMOS to communicate this regime paradigm shift to experts from sub-Saharan Africa. The first two quotes that you see are from two opening speeches made by two European experts affiliated with ICOMOS. The first one had been involved with the paradigm shift and understood it as now facilitating the representation of African heritage as part of humanity's heritage, anthropological parameters that reflect the African reality, as he put it. The second quote, "haunting charm of human being at its prime," illustrates, though, how the same anthropological parameters risk the recognition of non-monumental heritage as valorized primitiveness. The three quotes are from the expert discussions that followed throughout the day. Some experts argued that human arrangements of places defined African heritage. Others were cautious about a turn away from architectural sites. And their caution was not only about what might define the cultural heritage of sub-Saharan Africa, already a fraught question that should not have a single answer. Rather, it was about what those definitions meant in relation to this social order. That is, what part of humanity's cultural history would Africa occupy and on what terms? Zimbabwe's Minister of Home Affairs had opened the meeting by expressing the desire to see to it that, quote, Africa's cultural heritage assumes its rightful place in the global heritage, pointing to the importance of subject positions, a rightful place. But these discussions reflected concerns of subjectivity, that rightful place was not to be humanity's prime, rediscovered via the romanticism of imperial anthropology. In the book, I trace how these negotiations played out over multiple nominations of non-monumental sites and the creative deployments that mobilized the spiritual, vernacular, and the know-how without giving up, or without being able to give up, on notions of world-making mastery. The construction of humanity as a diverse subject also impacted the visions of solidarity that run through the regime. The vision of a diverse humanity opened the space for expressions of solidarity as cultural recognition due to the various parts of humanity. Representation and recognition became frames through which solidarity was extended to those seeking a place in the social order. While few openly rejected this framework of inclusion and recognition, not a hugely popular position, as the selected citations attest, these extensions of solidarity were mostly expressed by and to non-Western delegations. And for a while, at least, they seemed concerned with generating a flatter social order. That too would change. So in the last part of the book, I zero in on the post-2010 period, which analysts of the regime agree to have constituted a critical juncture. That juncture emerged at a potent political intersection. On the one hand, as we saw on the map and the list, the regime's hierarchies of social order endured post the paradigm shift, with growing resentment of international experts as producers of this hierarchy, both real and perceived, and also the BRICS countries' openly transgressive engagements with liberal international institutions after the 2008 financial crisis. This potent and critical juncture brought forth a third vision of humanity as a collective subject that is adequately represented by the community of states. This vision has not come with any new resources in relation to the symbolic universe. All the previous ones remain in circulation. But it has strongly implicated the social order, with state delegations increasingly positioning themselves and one another as the proper adjudicators, contributors, and custodians of world heritage, and through it, humanity. On the one hand, this vision of humanity draws from its diverse iteration. On the other hand, it attaches this diversity firmly to states. States are the representatives of humanity's diverse cultural parts. Thus, the claim goes, accepting states' nominations is all the recognition we need to acknowledge the cultural accomplishments of a diverse humanity. This centering sidelines experts, which has already been picked up by the scholarship, but it also sidelines others with their own claims to represent humanity's parts, such as civil society groups and indigenous peoples. At the same time, as I show in the book, this vision creates a problem for states as well. In their ardent quest for the prestige and recognition of having contributed to humanity's heritage, which is defined by outstanding universal value, and thus as having a more than national character, states risk reducing the World Heritage List to a politically acquired list of national honors. In other words, if humanity is the sum total of nation states, adjudicated by states as such, how can heritage ever have more than national value? This vision, then, in fact, ironically, risks unraveling the very possibility of the prestigious social order that emerges through humanity. My analysis of discussions at the World Heritage Committee meetings show that in order to maintain that social order, at the same time as they break it, and reap its prestige benefits, states continue to employ the resources of the regime's symbolic universe to discuss and support sites as having this more than national value and significance. So they know that they're maybe breaking the toy, and maybe they shouldn't fully break it, so they can continue to play with it, as one of my interviewees put it. Perhaps surprisingly, peace and solidarity have not ceased to be parts of engagements with World Heritage at this time. To the contrary, having established themselves centrally in the regime, states frequently refer to this link. For instance, they have insisted on the inscription of sites, especially in the Middle East, as contributing to peace by highlighting its past as a geography of thriving multiculturalism. It's also at this time that the regime has become home, or rather one of the homes, to a key state-led heritage project, namely China's revitalization of the Silk Road's history, or heritage. Beyond the regime, this revitalization is tightly tethered to the Belt and Road Initiative. Within World Heritage, the regime's symbolic universe is foregrounded. The Silk Roads are represented as a world historical instance of peaceful trade, exchange of ideas, and communication between diverse parts of humanity. And within that framing, China positions itself centrally as a political subject that has successfully steered a diverse humanity's peaceful global political relations in the past and can do so once again in a similarly multi-cored world. Heritage politics par excellence. The foregoing might have raised a need for a resolution, one that I am not particularly prone to giving. Aren't there visions of humanity and resources of its construction that get us out of these binds? And if not, should we just stop turning to humanity as containing better possibilities of global politics? If we follow my opening theoretical wager that constructions of humanity are generative of social and political orders, it becomes very hard to think of it as arranging all its component parts in relations of equality to one another and also to a collective subject. But such a flat universalism might not be the only, or even the best way, to arrive at good visions of peace and solidarity. And here, in not giving up on humanity, I take my cue from those who have insisted on humanity and on their humanity as part of imagining better possibilities of global politics. So let me conclude with one such articulation, which frames the nomination of the Bikini Atoll nuclear test site submitted by the Republic of Marshall Islands. It presents what I identify as a nested and uneven construction of humanity. What is striking about this construction is its ability to hold on to how global politics generates both a shared humanity that is thrown together by technologies such as nuclear weapons, at the same time as it places parts of that humanity in very uneven relations of dispossession and vulnerability. As the quote illustrates, the Bikini Atoll file is explicit about attending to these multiple meanings. These meanings include the loss of a homeland for the people of Bikini, a source of radiation for the nearby atolls, experience of loss and grief for other victims of nuclear colonialism, and irradiation for the service people at Bikini and other nuclear test sites who were not given adequate information or choices. The file does not dispense with the globality that marks the history it presents, but it also does not elide the fundamental hierarchies of this history for a flattened universalism. It comprehends the globality of the weapon's significance in reconfiguring humanity's relations to the possibilities of destruction, but also marks the meanings attached to these values and memories as multiple, contested, and contentious. Offering a poignant articulation of the loss of a homeland for the Marshallese, the file extends solidarity to others. especially, but not only, other indigenous populations who are exposed to the harms of nuclear weapons. That global mapping returns us to the formidable challenges of disarmament, but also opens up to expansive and at times unexpected solidarities. And while more fraught, this construction of a historical political humanity might just get us to better possibilities of peace and solidarity. Thank you. Also, while I could choose the book cover, I had no choice in the book pricing. So that's and it's on record now. But that's a 30% discount code for anyone who might be interested. Thank you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Right. Can you hear me okay? Yes, excellent. Wonderful talk. Thank you so much, Elif. Here's the book. I totally recommend it, as you will hear in a few minutes' time. So Elif writes in a book, this is a time when states assert themselves in the regime's implementation as possessors of sovereign prerogatives and as representatives of a diverse humanity. We might, of course, recognize this recentering of states across issues in world politics today. Interstate applications at the International Court of Justice, in which states try each other, such as the Gambia versus Myanmar, Ukraine versus Russia, and other kinds of genocide cases, South Africa versus Israel. We also see universal human rights under attack, obviously wars and conflict, which have left sites around the world devastated, sites that themselves will probably be inscribed onto this very regime that we were just talking about. Just recently, for example, Cambodia's memorial sites of the Khmer Rouge's repressive security regime were added in July 2025. This followed a moratorium that was put on these precise sites that was in place between 2018 and 2023. So despite the state-centeredness, humanity remains a subject that is invoked in contexts ranging from the climate crisis to crimes against humanity, as these examples show. Elif's book gives us a highly original account of an institution that has long claimed to act on humanity's behalf, UNESCO's World Heritage Regime. So through her global cultural history of the regime surrounding the UNESCO World Heritage Convention, Elif shows how sites are rendered legible as possessing so-called outstanding universal value. This is not merely a technical designation, as we just really saw, but a profoundly political act. The World Heritage Regime, she argues, is a politics of humanity. And this is a beautifully written book, which will make you smile and nod a lot. And what I thought I would do is to give you a little bit of a taste of what it's like reading this book to begin with. And so this is from the fourth chapter, the final chapter, in which we sort of get to that point in 2010 when states sort of reassert themselves in the regime. And this is how you start off giving us a vignette of what it's like doing that kind of field work. During one of the long days of the 2018 World Heritage Committee meeting in Bahrain, I boarded the early morning shuttle that ran from my hotel, a cheaper but still recommended option for the participants, to the Ritz-Carlton, where the meeting was being held. I watched delegation members come in and exchange polite nods, their faces having become familiar through shared elevator rides and encounters in a hotel cafeteria. As our shuttle started making its way across Manama, my neighbor, who was sitting between me and a member of an East African delegation, leaned over, pointed at some buildings, and said, "I have never seen an architectural style like that before." Glancing at their name tag, I noticed they were an expert, present at the meeting in an observer capacity. Feeling like an imposter, this time not as a PhD candidate, but as an IR scholar with minimal architectural knowledge, I nodded politely. Rightly dissatisfied with my conversational abilities, my neighbor turned to strike up a conversation with a delegation member. The expert began by recollecting family trips they had taken as a child, traveling from Europe to the delegate's country. Moving forward in time, the expert mentioned that they had recently gone back to said country with the idea for a research project on linguistic similarities along the East African coast, and shared their disappointment upon seeing the waters they swam in as a child populated with the many ships that come in and out of the newly constructed port. The delegate paused, then said, "Well, the world has changed." So we have heard in the talk the kind of three visions of humanity that you have excavated in your amazing field work. So just as a reminder, the three visions of humanity were first a humanity as a unified trans-historical and trans-geographic subject with a kind of singular bearer of heritage. Then we have humanity as a diverse subject, plural, differentiated, and culturally varied. And finally, humanity is adequately represented by the community of states, where states have become the political embodiment of humanity itself. And so the World Heritage List is the materialization of these visions. And through this designation of outstanding universal value, the regime attempts to curate a global cultural history as a shared inheritance of humankind. So what I wanted to do is to just briefly kind of highlight five different points and questions, just to kind of open up the discussion, see what you have to say. But obviously, I want to hear from the audience as well. And my first point is this relationship between cultural and symbolic power, which as a Bourdieusian scholar, I'm obviously very fascinated in. You describe the regime as constructing a kind of symbolic universe, and with all the conceptual resources through which humanity is represented, adjudicated, and brought into being. So at its heart, World Heritage inscription is not only preservation, it is also about building prestige. It is, as you write, a story of the pursuit of cultural prestige. Inscription confers universal recognition not only on sites, but on states, so it can become a form of symbolic power. And early on, universal value was closely attached to monumental architecture, what was seen as kind of grand civilizational achievements. But in 1994, you identified a partial paradigm shift. The regime loosened its attachment to monumentalism and opened itself up to vernacular creativity and harmonious human nature relations, which is a beautiful way of describing it. So the shift broadened the scope of what could count as universal, but it also created different kinds of hierarchies at the same point. So the question remained, how do you adjudicate universal value in radically diverse cultural practices? The expansion of categories did not eliminate power, but it redistributed it. So I'd like to ask you here how you think about the relationship between cultural prestige and the symbolic universe built around the universal, or in Bourdieusian terms, how does cultural capital become converted into symbolic power? Second, I also was really intrigued by the figure of the local expert, which I think is one of the most compelling contributions of the book as a general, is to think about these different kinds of subject positions within the regime, international experts, local experts, state representatives, but also the broader communities that are at stake. And so the local expert emerges as a kind of hybrid figure. You're right, if the international expert indexes scientific technical authority grounded in epistemic disciplines, the local expert indexes knowledge embedded in cultural matricism, such as language skills, contextual awareness, cultural significance. And interestingly, your interviews often preferred local experts, not because they straddled different kinds of epistemic worlds, but because they were positioned between kind of professional knowledge and local political embeddedness. But this inclusion remains fraught, as we see. Community members often express dissatisfaction. They're unhappy at being treated as merely one stakeholder among many rather than as custodians with a kind of active voice. So recognition, as you make clear, is not redress. Visibility through World Heritage inscription does not necessarily resolve historical marginalization. So the regime expands a symbolic universe to include diversity, but its adjudicative authority remains structured and contested. So my question here is, how can these different kinds of actors maybe circulate between these different subject positions? At what point is the local expert becoming international experts, as we look at their biographies, right, where they, you know, can become state representatives at some point as well? And how do they negotiate these kinds of conflicting subject positions? Third point is about representation, universality, and the role of anthropology, which is really, really interesting in this kind of nexus between representation and the universal. As universal value expanded beyond monumental architecture, anthropological parameters entered the regime, and kind of anthropological language became really central towards articulating diversity, cultural difference, local specificity, but not necessarily a kind of form of universal. Nomination dossiers, as we saw, became sort of creative engagement. engagements with older monumental criteria and newer diversity-oriented ones. And I really enjoy this moment when you play and kind of really show us this creativity, right? How states learn to speak the language of harmonious human-nature relations, intangible practices, and cultural landscapes. But the core question persists, right? What does it mean to ascribe universal value to diverse practices? And underrepresentation is often invoked as a justification for ascription, right? Equitable geographic distribution becomes proof of equal dignity of all cultures. We also see that in human rights kind of expert committees to make sure you have experts from all around the world. But universality and representation pull in different kinds of directions. And if humanity is simply the aggregation of states, can it be more than the sum of its parts? And states navigate this by reverting to themselves as the legitimate representatives and adjudicators of universal value. So how can a regime basically start to inhabit this kind of universal? Almost getting to the end. And finally, this question about the return of states and the marginalization of experts, which you identify from around 2010 onwards, right, where states start to reassert themselves more forcefully, something which we also see in the human rights regime with the kind of reform of the then UN Commission on Human Rights becoming the Human Rights Council and state really making sure that they're appointing, you know, different kinds of independent experts. And so committee members also started overturning expert evaluations at that point as well. So we see politics being really at the core, at the center of these kinds of evaluations and inscriptions, right? Humanity becomes represented as the aggregation of states, and this further marginalizes these different kinds of groups, civil society, local communities, but also international experts who have, you know, built a career in these kinds of evaluations. And you mentioned Bikini et al. In your talk, there's also Hiroshima Peace Memorial, for example, is very interesting kind of ways in which different stakeholders negotiate this, right? But also transboundary nominations by states when they nominate, you know, cultural, you know, sites across boundaries as a kind of way to reach out and perform that solidarity, which is quite interesting. So the final point, I know I'm getting towards the end of my time, is to think about, you know, what you actually mentioned in your beautiful picture here, right? It's a collection of state representatives, experts, but also UNESCO kind of secretariat members, right? There's an ongoing struggle between experts, states, and the secretariat. Is that how you would sort of characterize it, which we obviously see in all sorts of international organizations, right? But the aim is not to kind of romanticize a purely technocratic past, as you say in the book, right? But it's really kind of looking at this negotiation between political and epistemic authority that is happening between all of these different actors, right? And this balance is always delicate, always shifting. So what has changed is the caste and power of actors within that balance. But humanity does not disappear, as we can see, right? Even in this era of sovereign resurgence, it continues to be invoked in relation to climate crisis, crimes against humanity, but also informed in different kinds of forms of global cooperation. So just to conclude, the politics of world heritage, Elif's book, ultimately invites us to rethink heritage, not as a conversation policy, but as a global political theory and practice. In a moment when global order is in flux, Elif shows that the struggle over stones, landscapes, and memory is also a struggle over the political subject of humanity itself.
Thanks, both of you, for sharing your expertise. We'll open the floor to questions now from the audience, both here and online. Just as a reminder for those online, please type your questions in the Q&A box. And for everyone, please state your name and your affiliation. Folk in the room, please do take a microphone to make sure that everyone can hear properly and as well for the recording. The floor is open for questions. We'll take three at a time.
She decides.
Yeah. Someone's begging to be honest.
Let's start over here and let's take, let's begin with you, the person with the red sweater around their neck and then the burgundy sweater behind.
Thank you so much. Really fascinating talk. So I have the UNESCO World Heritage app on my phone. And when I scroll through it, it does sort of come across as this national honor roll, as you mentioned. So very interesting to think of it as more than that. But my question is, you know, this idea of, you know, the states as communities, states as humanity is really interesting. And, you know, when you bring up, you know, the role of the Silk Road visions for humanity, and how that's really part of Belt and Road Initiative, I couldn't help but think about the U.S. and the U.S.'s role in, you know, leaving UNESCO and even in sort of contesting that regime. So I'm just wondering sort of what we are to make of you know, a hegemon like the US contesting the regime and the way it's doing and what that means for those visions. My name is Brandon Heibloom, and I'm a master's student at the International Relations Department here.
Good evening. My name is Lydia, and I'm doing my master's in international political economy here. I have two questions. So the first is around the debate on the inflation of the World Heritage Sites. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on the fact that, is it supposed to go on forever? Are we just going to add more and more sites, or is it supposed to be an exclusive list? And the second question is around the natural sites. I'm wondering, because we've been you've been talking a lot about humanity. So how does the human side intersect the natural sites? Do we look at the natural sites still as human-centered, or is there a sort of multi-species lens perhaps applied? Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm Sebastian, and I'm an art historian, so the question will revolve around that. But So you very eloquently and amazingly described the shift between monumentalism to more local. I wanted to ask if you have noticed between among your colleagues, you also a shift in the methodology of the study, because I see a shift towards making our sciences, art history and heritage more and more scientific, but based on facts and hard data, but also influenced by, of course, the American system, let's put it like that. Whereas in order to actually study these local histories in a more effective way, we should also shift the methodology towards a more arts and humanities system. Have you seen such a shift, or do you think we are stuck in a scientific methodology to try to study something that doesn't have the retraceability of monumental history? Because that's, of course, is the advantage of the monumental history, or its retraceability, and which makes it very easy to study in a more scientific way. Thank you.
Sure. I think we'll have time for one more round. So the US leaving UNESCO, I'll just do it in order. So in some ways, and I think this was coming in Alvina's comments very nicely as well, there's a way of thinking about UNESCO as a thing in itself, or World Heritage as a thing in itself, but also as a thing that is, one, very much embedded in these broader patterns of global politics. And I think in the conclusion, I try to think of it as also in some ways really paralleling the ebbs and flows of the liberal international order, right? With its sort of very optimistic universalism at the outset. And then what if we pluralize, would that work? And then kind of global politics taking it over post 2008, 2010, especially, right? And so it's, and one of the things that I talk in the book is also sort of this moment in 2010, that critical juncture meeting. You have, for example, it's in Brazil, and some of the frames are, what is the new vision under which we can all unite? So it's staged very explicitly as that. Now, the US, it's had a up and down relationship with UNESCO for a very long time. So that's why I mentioned Amadou Mahtar Mabou when he was the director general of UNESCO. The U.S. was very unhappy with what it saw as a sort of rampant third worldism and left. And then the U.K. followed suit, and then they came back in the 1980s, if I'm not mistaken. The relation has also then refractured when the Palestinian Authority was admitted as an observer to UNESCO. That's when the U.S. said no more. And so what has happened in that case, which is interesting because the U.S. was quite involved at the beginning. This whole World Heritage was its idea, in fact. And it was with a very strong U.S. intervention that the experts' idea of doing conservation aid became this recognition regime. So it was there at the founding, but it was never very active in terms of nominating sites. So it never was the top of the list, which is currently constantly a standoff between Italy and China, for those who are interested. So then this hegemonic pullout, it was experienced as a decline in material resources, but China has far and away stepped in. So in the case of UNESCO, there's a very clear sort of, this is an institution through which to do Silk Roads. It's also the institution in which there's a lot of talk about AI governance, actually. And we didn't talk about it, but last time we did one of these panels, someone said, you know, this is, I realize all of the tech bros, to use a scientific term, they keep talking about humanity and the future of humanity too. So it's really quite interesting to sort of follow, right? I mean, there's a way that global politics is becoming state-centric in undeniable ways, but who is sort of emerging and mobilizing humanity and to what end, I think is going to continue to fascinate me, and maybe we can all be fascinated together. So in that case, that it hasn't felt like a hegemonic sort of objection in ways that it can be felt in other domains, like humanitarian aid and the kinds of recent pullouts or even climate change. So here there was a very clear nature doesn't like a vacuum. This is going to be filled financially and politically. So that's the answer. Will the list go on forever? I mean, in a way, so, and this for me, let me also pick up on another point that Alvina made. And here I'm going to apologize for revealing my not art historian, solidly grounded in global politics. So for me, I don't know if anything very significant happens if, like, sites are added for not good enough reasons in terms of cultural terms. So a few more will be protected. We'll probably, some of us will be grouchy tourists because we're going to go to one and we'll be like, where's the outstanding universal value? I didn't see it. I hated it. We'll leave a Google review and call it good. Mm-hmm. What I think is less okay is actually the dynamics that Alvina was talking about that happen around now, some of these sites with contested histories. And so Cambodia, the sites of the Rwandan genocide, and those have been sort of either very recently nominated and inscribed, or they're waiting in line. And there is, I think, a potential political bad in which certain histories become institutionally endorsed as the universally valuable ones. And it happens through all of these debates and objections. But when the dust is settled, and if you haven't been watching these hours and hours of debate, what you're going to do is to open the app or open the website, and you're going to see UNESCO's label, and under it, you're going to see the site, and you will think, oh, this is an international institution and one that is not sort of very delegitimated, and they have endorsed this. And so I think that's the political problem. And that's kind of where the book ends, and that I don't mind if there's like irrelevant palaces and gardens there. But I think this is actually something that is of political concern. And that's I think, what there is to make a bigger fuss about as scholars of global politics. I'll leave the OUV debates to the experts on sort of parks and palaces. But I think from where I'm sitting, that's the bigger problem. And then for natural heritage, yes, I think so. When the regime sort of took off, especially, this was also a very anthropocentric convention of nature. And it was sort of almost the Kantian sublime and the awe-striking. So it was very much nature as it is valuable to human. And over time, it has gone more into sort of biodiversity. So it has followed those debates and has tried to sort of become less anthropocentric. And it has also tried to move beyond the really bad, like, sort of vastly critique nature versus culture divide, which also is very particular to parts of the world and not to others. So there have been attempts at sort of similarly making these paradigm shifts from this sort of very staunch modernity, enlightenment, this is nature, this is culture, and this is why each are valuable, to trying to rethink some of those. And now a lot of it is also rethought within the lens of climate change, including actually not, will the list go on forever, but what does it mean to preserve anything when nothing feels very preservable, right? So that's the bigger sort of end of that modernity optimism reckoning, that is, we don't know what it means to preserve and for how long. Then the study. Yes. So this is, I think that this is what Alvina was also picking up on, that I think there has been this really exactly that tension you're pointing to, that at the beginning, exclusive as it was and problematic for all of those reasons, something aligned in sort of, this is universal value, these are the sites, and this is how we can judge it. And they could say, well, in terms of the Baroque, like, this is the biggest, like, I'm running into my expertise very quickly here, but they could do that. They could say, here's all the sort of Middle Age Gothic church examples, and of those, this has the best symmetry, and this is, how do you do that when you say humanity is diverse, right? What is universal value going to mean? And I don't know. They don't know. So what ends up happening is actually exactly this tension where expert reports have become more scientific. They do these very extensive comparative studies to arrive at a, we don't really know, right? So the science as a method has actually deepened to speak to this uncertainty, but then the result ends up actually, there's a lot less outright rejections. It's like, could you tell us a bit more? Because it's really not clear. And there's something about the substance and the method and the aspiration that are not hanging neatly together. And so that's where the regime is exactly. But they haven't figured their way out of it yet, or won't probably, most likely.
Can we have a question from the online community?
Hello. So we've had a few questions about identity. So I'll just try and combine them so we can be quick. So does World Heritage determine identity? And do you think this identity needs to be more carefully constructed? So they're talking about a development of a world identity.
Can you say the last part again?
Okay. So does this identity need to be more carefully constructed? So talking about a world identity and whether World Heritage determines identity.
Mm-hmm. Make it clear. Oh, okay. he was from the first round, yeah.
Hi, thank you so much. This was really, really fascinating. I'm a fellow in the Department of Government. it's amazing to see how these ideas have shifted. And it's incredible that you've done this crazy work at like really kind of tracing this sort of change. But I wanted to go back to what Sebastian said before, because you said maybe this is not exactly my domain in a sense, but I was kind of missing a story or a narrative of what explains this shift from one narrative to the next, and perhaps figuring out who are these experts and what kind of voting pattern do they vote on these things, or do they resolve to some sort of democratic procedure? And I think I was kind of expecting some story about the institutional rules of the game that are being employed. But otherwise, it's a fantastic work. So yeah, well done. Yeah.
We can take one more. Julia, yeah, since you're there.
Thank you very much, Elif. I'm Julia Sharati from the Department of International Relations. I actually have a very quick question for you, but I've also been working a bit on world heritage in my work. And one thing that I've been reflecting upon is the question of materiality. And so I wonder if in your story, the notion of heritage sites as being material plays any role in the way that this regime has been constructed and this construction of humanity. And this leads to like a very quick follow-up, and that's we are now looking at a time where UNESCO is looking more like not just World Heritage Sites, but also intangible heritage. And what's the story there? Thank you.
Okay. let me do those three. So maybe actually I'll start from the middle. What explains this shift? So it depends. So in the first, right, and that's why it's not a sort of, okay, that's not only why. I wanted to tell this story around these conceptualizations of humanity and the kinds of both the drives they generate in terms of how to narrate oneself and but also what emerges from them. But the other reason why I didn't sort of do that kind of different institutional work is because, for example, from the first to the second period, it is really expert-led, the change, right? The paradigm shift. And they're the ones, states are unhappy, but they don't quite know how to do this because they don't speak the language. And there's a lot of archival work. And from very early on, especially sort of Brazil, there's Senegal, they realize that this is going in a way that they will never be represented. But what they keep saying is, we're not going to be represented. So they don't say, could we look at these anthropological resources? Could we look at these other things? Because it is sort of the language of what is going to make outstanding universal value. So it's the level of technicality and the kind of universe that this is constructed in. So what you get are, for example, proposals like, could we just get rid of the universal and call it outstanding universal value? Can we add outstanding regional value? Or, for example, you have actually this thing from Brazil that I was really struck by, because it says something to the effect of, well, this is always going to disadvantage countries that are, quote, young in their encounter with civilization. So you have this very interesting sort of reproduction of that. And you don't, it's until, like in a very strange turn of events, it's until Isaac Shiva, a French anthropologist, that says, enough of this, we're doing know-how, we're doing vernacular now. And then you have Australian and Canadian experts that have been going through this domestically with Indigenous groups and saying, this nature-culture distinction, that is not our heritage. So you have those particular sets of experts that end up having this one-day-long meeting, and from there, the global strategy emerges and states that were unhappy say, yes, this please. We didn't know how to articulate, like we didn't have these other resources to say, this is how we can change OUV and then it will fit our site. So that's very expert-led. But then in 2010, nothing changes in the criteria. Then you really have this BRICS assertion of, we've had enough. And Christoph Brumann, who's also, he went to the 2009 meeting, which was before I started my PhD. And he has these interviews where state delegations are like, we've had enough of Europeans thinking they can run this show. And that's a very different assertion and a very different change. So again, that's a sort of, I hang it on to then what happens within, right? And then what comes out of this, because it's not kind of the same kind of mechanism. There's also a lot of variance, for example, in how the expert panels are convened. So I talk about that. At the beginning, three men decide that some of them are so short. So I've read all 280 of those expert reports. So there are patterns. They're there, I promise. But not in these sort of. But some of them are like, oh, this is so obvious. Actually, explaining why it has universal value would be insulting. So you get from this kind of, we're all inhabiting this value universe, and isn't this? Yes, of course, it's the Taj Mahal and the pyramids, but also the Louvre. And so you have this very clear, like we all agree, right, about what does it, right? And then that changes. So the expert panels begin to change. And then at first it's the, we should be regionally representative. And then they realize, oh, wait, it should also be based on sites that are nominated so that people have. So now what they're struggling with is you have sites of conscience being nominated, but mostly art historians on the board. So I assume that's going to result in another shift, right? So all of those within and across periods do change as well, but all of the periods then have some sort of consistency in being marked by a dominant narrative that kind of shapes things. Okay. World heritage, it does not determine identity. It creates fraught negotiations of identity because of this kind of more than national attribute of it. And states want to project themselves, but they want to also sort of be legible to it. So I do talk about it in some site-based terms, but I would say world heritage shapes or creates incentives to narrate identities in certain ways, and those are fraught and ongoing. The materiality. So it's one of the things that happens between the tangible and intangible, and again, this links nicely back, that by the time they get to intangible heritage, they use the language of representative and not the language of universal. And something does like the shift from this was in 1972 with a very clear, we're only going to do immovable heritage. And that was at the range of multiple concerns, but it was clearly material. It was clearly in this language of universal. And then by the time it became clear, we can't tack immaterial onto this and we're going to do a new regime around it. It was also remarkable that it never adopted the language of universal, but it adopted the language of representative. So, and I haven't ventured into it, but I know that that's a key distinction and one that I find fascinating. So if you write about it, I'll read it.
Lisa, do we have another question from online?
No, I don't.
Okay, one last question.
We can do one more, I feel.
There's one here, there.
Lovely.
Last one?
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Anna. I'm studying here at the European Institute in Masters, and I was wondering about monuments or pieces that could go or potentially be nominated to become sites of or part of the World Heritage, but have been displaced due to colonial mechanics. So, for example, certain items that have been taken during events of colonial injustice. So, say certain elements of African heritage in France or in the UK, and if there is a mechanism to deal with those kind of situations within the nomination sphere. Is it the country that in which it is located, the who is the nominant, but then to whom is it then, of whose heritage is that item then part of, etc. So I was wondering if in your research you encountered anything dealing with those complex mechanics.
Yeah. Nice, light, easy question to end on. Okay, so there is a mechanism for that. So, okay, and this goes a bit back to the materiality question. So World Heritage is only on immovable heritage sites. And while I know there's the Parthenon, I mean, there's the Elgin marbles. What is immovable, you ask? The British will have a very different sense of that. It's really good this is recorded. But strictly speaking, it's immovable things that have stayed in their place. But that doesn't mean that it's always actually easy. For example, one of the sites that if you open World Heritage, you will see the old city of Jerusalem as nominated by Jordan and during the sort of protectorate role. And that's the only site that doesn't exist under a country name because it was allowed at a time where if this was nominated now, they would say, we're going to do a moratorium and we're going to. But it was inscribed because the experts decided that there were incredibly valuable heritage sites. And then this is actually one of those examples, if I can come back. Especially early on, a lot of decisions were unanimous. And more recently, it's through discussion, and it's only in very contentious instances that there's voting. This was a very early case of voting, but it's mostly going to be by way of trying to get numerical majorities during discussions in cases of disagreement. But for the longest time, that was also just yes, Taj Mahal, yes, like let's or it was a no altogether. But what ends up happening are essentially the contested cases are not looted heritage artifacts, but it's sites on contested borders. So the Cambodia-Thailand border, that's one, and the inscription of a World Heritage site actually resulted in clashes for 3 days. And that's because the convention says states can only nominate sites within their boundaries. And then if you reverse that, it comes to if you have nominated it, then it's within your boundaries. Mm-hmm. And that can get sometimes mobilized. And then the UNESCO official position is the nomination, the inscription of a site is not a decision on its territorial something, something, but that, so there is that, and it's happened a few times. The instinct is to try to do diplomatic negotiation before it ever comes on the table, or continue to postpone it. There's also, in former Yugoslavia, there are a few sites that are of similar faith. But yes, it happens, and it would be fascinating to research if anyone's interested.
All right, thanks everyone. I think it's been a great pleasure for everyone who's here to listen to you tonight. Thanks for the presentation, the comments, for everyone to ask questions. Thanks for taking time out of your day, your night, wherever you are. And please come again in the future.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.